That's because he has sex desire. So I have my sex desire. So if I want to become spiritually advanced, if I want to become a Vaishnava, taking the meaning Vaishnava like Vishnu, then I have to satisfy my desires as Krishna satisfied his. This is how they understand being a Vaishnava. And of course they view Lord Chaitanya and the Panchatattva in the same way, and they give so many arguments. Just like Krishna, they say, it's obvious that Krishna had a material body because he died when he was shot in the foot by an arrow. And it's obviously Lord Nityananda had a material body because when that Madai threw the pot on his head, he bled. So they give these arguments from the scriptures. So Lord Vishnu, he receives his body from parents, from mother, father. So all Vaishnavas receive their bodies from parents. So in other words, Vaishnavas, Vishnu and Vaishnavas, they're born from parents, from the combination of semen and blood. And they're also subject to death, obviously. And this also justifies this seminal line, which we've already mentioned, Jati Gosai. This justifies the so-called Nityananda Vamsa, etc. Vaishnavism is handed down in that way. So in this way also, then Vaishnavas can be categorized according to caste, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Sudras. We read in Srila Prabhupada's purport, Mlecha, European, Yavana. You can put these adjectives in front of Vaishnava, no problem. Because Vaishnava means this material body. And so there's so many things that emanate from this. That, for instance, Krishna, he was very much attached to his mother, Yashoda, his father, Nanda Maharaj, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and mother Sachi and Jagannath Mishra. They had such a very nice family life. So why is it that we have to renounce? We see God himself is enjoying family life. Prabhupada mentions this in one purport. The sahajiyas say Nityananda Prabhu was sent to Bengal to produce progeny. He was to get married and produce a dynasty. And this dynasty would be the Nityananda Vamsa dynasty. Just like Garuda, who is the Lord's eternal associate, he's entitled to eat fish. So the sons of Acharyas, coming in the seminal line of disciplic succession, they're also entitled to eat fish. This is also Vaishnava Dharma. And since Vaishnavism is determined by the blood flowing in the veins, by the material body, so if we have sexual enjoyment with other lady Vaishnavas, as many as possible, this is divine activity. We're simply taking the mercy of their loving association. This is Vaishnava activity. Oh, also the sahajas, another very, very major aspect of their idea is humility with a capital H. Humility means accept anything, you see. Don't criticize anyone. Be very humble. If you see some god brother or fellow so-called Vaishnava engaging in whatever sinful activity, don't ever criticize him. It is all divine, it is all transcendental. You have to be humble. And similarly, if someone is coming and chastising you for whatever incredible, abominable activity you have just done, you see, just be humble. He's an illusion, but just be humble. Don't make any offense back. You see, Param Vaishnava. So, in this way, out of humility, the sahajas won't preach. Out of humility, the sahajas won't follow regulative principles, because that will make them puffed up. Out of humility, the sahajas won't study the scriptures, because that makes one proud. They accuse Jiva Goswami of not actually having been, he was not really a Vaishnava, because he was a big philosopher, a big puffed up jnani. So you don't need to study scriptures. Be very humble. They also say that it is better, they say things like, it is better not, if one is coming from a low caste, you see, been initiated into the Vaishnava religion, but from a low caste, then it's better not to engage in devotional activities like worshipping deity or anything like that, because you'll become puffed up. Leave that to the families who have inherited the deity. Prabhupada mentions in one purport, therefore, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, therefore, they say the title Prabhupada should only be addressed to one who's born in some so-called Vaishnava line. He may be called Prabhupada because he has right by birth to manage a mutt, to worship the deity and so on. And newcomers who are taking diksha, they should keep their place, they should be humble. Just give money, support the born Vaishnavas, like that. Yeah, the sahajas, we mentioned this. They see no difference between Harinam, Namabhas, Namaparad. The holy name has its own power. Doesn't matter how you chant it. And it doesn't matter what you're doing while you chant it. Take the name in any condition. It's always spiritually effective. So then, Bivalamangala Thakur, he became Krishna conscious by hearing instructions from the prostitute Chintamani. So therefore, why can't others also become Krishna conscious by hearing instructions, kirtan and so on from prostitutes? And if you think that that sounds rather extreme, just in the back there is one ashram flag, it's behind the Gurukul. So some time ago they were having big kirtan festival, and I was hearing, I couldn't understand what was going on. I was hearing on the loudspeakers someone was singing. I didn't know what it sounded like, a young boy, but crying and trembling voice. And I wonder who's making it, and singing and then stopping and then talking and Krishna, Krishna, and then weeping and all this. I was wondering what's going on. So I walked back to see, and it was a woman. You see, there was a woman standing before the microphone, everyone else sitting down, and she had her hair all out, and she was singing and crying and making gestures and making these eye movements on everyone and exhibiting so-called transcendental symptoms. So this is very apropos. You may say, well, this is a prostitute. Because Prabhupada says, any woman who likes to appear in front of audience and put on show like that, must be prostitute. So you may make that objection. This is a prostitute. And that's the answer. Well, Vimalamangala Thakur, he heard a prostitute and he became Krishna conscious. So we're also following the same program. Oh, here's another good one. If some arrangement of sufficient hourly payment can be made, then confidential scriptures of transcendental mellows on Ras Leela, on Krishna stealing the cowherd damsel's clothes, on such scriptures as Vidagdha Madhava, Krishna Karnamrita, Govinda Leelamrita, Mukta Charita, Gita Govinda, Jagannath Ballabh Natikam, or the songs of Vidyapati or Chandidas, as long as proper amount of money is being paid, then they can be freely recited for everyone's benefit. Now these are of course very confidential scriptures. Srila Prabhupada warned us again and again. These are only meant for the most advanced devotees on the transcendental platform. Only they can understand. But the sahajas, they say no, as long as one is getting enough money, then you can recite for those who are paying. I have here many examples of wrong conclusions taken from the lives of Mahaprabhu and his associates. So, just like they say, Mahaprabhu, he ate so much. Chaitanya Charitamrita describes he's taking great amount of prasadam. So they use this as an excuse to themselves indulge the tongue. And then there's so many other examples which we don't really have to go through. You're getting, I think you get the idea. Examples from Janavi Devi or Pundarik Vidyanidhi, Ramananda Roy, Srinivasacharya. Oh, and here's another one. Another good one. Show this Sahaja mentality. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Chaitanya Bhagavat, we find that Vrindavan Das Thakur is criticizing the non-Vaishnavas with such terms. He's using such words as devil, demon, sinner, cheater, I kick upon their heads, jackal, dog. So he's using these kind of adjectives to describe the offensive non-devotees. So the sahajyas, they conclude, so this shows Vrindavan Das Thakur, he was subject to anger, he was subject to envy, he lacked humility. So this means, you see again, if anyone criticizes them, that's how they will see it. Oh, he's just puffed up, not a real devotee. So what this means is, Prakriti Sahaja mentality means seeing everything in material light. So even if a Vaishnava, a real Vaishnava comes to try to deliver them by first of all pointing out their faults, they cannot understand it. They take that also in a material way. The Sahajas, in the same way, they will see faults in the Acharya, in the spiritual master. They'll commit, go that far in committing offense. The sahajas have also made up many false stories. For instance, that Rupa Goswami, everything he learned about devotional service, he actually learned from Mirabai, this lady devotee who was famous, Rajasthani devotee. And other such stories. So, that is also very, as I say, there's very, very much on this. And I've just gone down a great deal of information, selected out certain tidbits. You have a question? Well, as I say, sahajya, it's more a mentality than, you see, because all these groups can be called sahajya. And sahajya can simply be a mentality that appears in someone who's seen externally as a bona fide Vaishnava. So if you ask how are they seen externally, that's very hard to say. It depends on how they appear externally. They may appear as, you know, Pakka Vaishnava. But in the mind, they're carrying such offensive ideas. And we've seen in recent times, there's now currently controversy brewing in our movement with one group in Mississippi, USA. They publish a magazine, Vedic Village Review. So we see many of these tendencies which have been described here cropping up in their writing, in their whole attitude. For instance, I don't think this is really the place to get into all the details, but I can just point out some little things. For instance, they take Srila Prabhupada gave some instructions at the time of just before his departure and how the disciplic succession shall go on. So they've taken a few isolated quotes here and there, and they've tried to build up a whole other story of what really happened. And their conclusion is, this in itself is already a sahajya tactic, devising false stories to prove some wrong point. And their conclusion is that the disciplic succession ended with Srila Prabhupada, the parampara system, where spiritual master accepts disciples. Prabhupada is the guru of ISKCON. And everyone else who comes to ISKCON now and any time in the future will simply become direct disciple of Srila Prabhupada. Everyone is Prabhupada's disciple. Just that there may be what they call ritvik, some professional priest or proxy, stand-in, who does a fire yajna and gives a name, but it's just a ceremony. Actually, the new devotee is becoming Prabhupada's disciple. So this is their conclusion. They have different arguments. And as I say, I don't want to go into it, but if you examine these arguments that they make to come to this conclusion, you find the sahajya tendency pervades them all very, very clearly. Actually, to come to this conclusion, for instance, they have to, the implication is that Prabhupada made mistakes. I don't want to get into that, but that's the obvious implication that they're making. So this is the sahajya outlook. Yes, the acharya makes mistakes, like any teacher. Just like you may take a university course, learn some mundane subject, and you'll see faults in your teacher. He stutters or sometimes forgets something or whatever like that. So everyone in the class, because it's mundane education, everyone kind of takes that into stride. Yeah, you know, he's just the teacher. So to come to their philosophical conclusion actually means you have to see Prabhupada in that light. And I could mention many other things, but actually what I want to really talk about is simply the conclusion that they make of this ritvik. So I just happened to hear, it was a remarkable revelation yesterday from Kirnas Prabhu, who's just come from Bangladesh. So he told there's one sahajya group in Bangladesh right now that was founded by Anukul Chandra Thakur, who is now dead. So their system for bringing newcomers into the fold is the Ritvik system. Someone can become a Ritvik guru if he's a full-time vegetarian. That qualification must be there. Then he can go out and preach, and he gives initiation, but it's only on behalf of Anukul. Whoever he's initiating becomes Anukul Chandra's disciple, because Anukul is God. So there's no one who can stand between God and the living entity. God is God. God is eternally God. So Anukul being God, he has direct connection with everyone anyway. It's interesting to note that the same philosophy was there in Ramakrishna Mission. That was propagated by Sarada Devi, Ramakrishna's wife. After Ramakrishna left, there was a big fight in that mutt between Sarada Devi and Vivekananda. Because Vivekananda, he considered himself to be guru. So he wanted to give diksha on his own in the name of, you see, as being the disciple of Ramakrishna. And Ramakrishna's wife, she didn't accept this. She said, "You're not qualified to represent him. You're just an ordinary living entity. Ramakrishna was God." So she was giving initiation like that too, as Ritvik. So we see where all this Ritvik stuff actually comes from. It comes from Mayavadi, Sahajyas. And in this Sahaja, Anukul Chandra Thakur's mission. So to take Ritvik, one has to accept one regulatory principle. Once a week should be vegetarian. Then you can take the Ritvik Diksha. Become disciple, direct disciple of Anukul Chandra. So we see this, you see, as soon as such idea is permitted, that one can become direct disciple of departed spiritual master, then the standard is immediately going to go down. Because one of the most important functions of the spiritual master, actually Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in Harinam Chintamani concerning the spiritual master, the spiritual master must be strict with his disciples. He must correct them. Before he initiates anyone, he must bring them up to the standard of sadhana bhakti. They must prove that they can live according to the rules and regulations of Krishna consciousness. Only then can he give them initiation. And then after initiation, if they start to go off the track, he's responsible to put them back on the track. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, unless one accepts a spiritual master like that, then accepting spiritual master is useless. It will bear no fruit. So what to speak? I mean, that's a useless spirit. So what to speak of a spiritual master who is not visible to our senses, who is not there to give any instruction? Who will correct the disciples? So it naturally means, as soon as such system is introduced, that the whole standard will have to be brought down. And it leads like to the same contamination you find in Christianity. Then everyone's running around, this direct disciple of Christ. There's even a church called Disciples of Christ. And they pray, they do their whatever service they're doing, form of worship. And then any inspiration that comes in the mind, that's also directly from, that's order from Christ. So in this way they can justify anything. It's quite ridiculous, actually. Hallucinatory devotional service. It's all hallucination. So this sahajya mentality being so vast, it's so unlimited. I just gave a little skimming off the top. But you can just appreciate the essence of it It means a complete materialistic attitude. Although one is, somehow or other, they're interested in passing themselves off as being Vaishnavas. That's very important to them, to be accepted as Vaishnavas. But their whole understanding, practice, mood, everything is fully materialistic. Examples are given in this section that to show how the Sahaja mentality can be traced back to the beginning of the world. One example is given of Hiranyakashipu, who saw his son Prahlad in a total materialistic light. Prahlad was a Vaishnava. But Hiranyakashipu was thinking, no, he's my son. So he should do what I say. This type of attitude, which we can understand is demoniac, totally offensive. This type of attitude has been brought forward by these Sahajas and made to look like Vaishnavism. It's actually the same mentality. Or Indra, when Lord Indra wanted to punish the residents of Vrindavan for not worshipping him. So he was taking the Vaishnavas just to, and Krishna just to be ordinary conditioned souls under his authority. So this is actually the essence of it. It is hardcore materialistic demoniac mentality. But these Sahajas have very expertly dressed it up to look like Vaishnavism, and especially they stress this humility. They're always acting very humble. So if you see them, you think, well, you know, he doesn't seem like such a bad person. So, you know. But that humility is totally deceptive, because by that humility they accept all the wrong things, all inauspicious things. And then they consider themselves too humble to accept the good things. Too humble to go out and preach, you know, because we, who am I to disturb the conditioned souls? Krishna says we shouldn't disturb them. But, you know, but eating fish, yes, I will do that because I don't want to, you know, everybody else in this community eats fish, so if I don't eat fish, then they'll think badly of me. So we shouldn't do this. We're Vaishnavas. We shouldn't cause anybody any trouble. So they're very, very expert.
Can you elaborate a little on the vows and the time you're running another?
Well, we're out of time, and we'll go into that tomorrow. Because I wanted to deal with Sahaja at length, because the rest of these are Sahajas. And then we can just go through the list tomorrow and describe their prominent symptoms. And then you can know what an owl is, what a sakibeki is, and so on and so forth. And just know that at the root of all of them is this Sahaja mentality, which, as I said, is a combination of lust, gross material lust, an impersonal mental speculation. It's a very neat mix. And it's very, very ancient. Before there were Sahaja Vaishnavas, there were Sahaja Buddhists, there were Sahaja Muslims, and ultimately it all goes back to Tantra. It's a very, very ancient and weird form of so-called religion. So, Hare Krishna. With different varieties of Prakriti Sahajya, we introduced the general Sahajya conception, doctrine, yesterday. And we shall now further look at the permutations of this Sahaja mood. So we have to go through 10 upper sampradayas today. So that means it's a brief treatment of each one. So the first one is Aula. So the word owl is a transformation, derivation of a Persian word, atul, Do you still have that word in Persian? Atul means afflicted.
Atul?
Atul. This word is often used as a suffix to convey the sense of pain and affliction. Like someone may be afflicted because of hunger, because of thirst, because of suffering, and also because of acute separation from the lover. In Persian or Arabic, this word also means someone who is superior or the best. Atul. Okay. It is sometimes also used as a form of address to someone in a senior and respectable position, or even your elder brother. Is that right?
Atul. Something like this. It's tul, not atul exactly.
Oh, tul.
It means long and big and greatness.
Mm-hmm.
That's
language.
But it can be the Persian that they use in
Afghanistan. Yeah. Well, this word, you see, this word aul is found in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So it's, you know, 500 years ago. This owl is a Bengali, you know, corruption of a Persian word from that time. So languages change. So probably even in present day Persian it sounds different. Anyway, the main idea is this affliction of acute separation from the lover. In English they say love sick. This is how this word aul is meant. So, the aul process, I should mention that the word aul, it appears in scripture. For instance, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila chapter 8, text 23, Anti Lila chapter 13, text 26, Anti Lila chapter 14, text 51, Anti Lila chapter 17, text 46, Anti Lila chapter 19, text 21. But all the Acharyas in our Sampradaya have explained the meaning of the word aul in the context of being afflicted by transcendental love. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had this kind of affliction, being in the mood of, we've already mentioned, Vipralamba, the mood of separation from Krishna. Actually, Radharani's Mahabhava mood of separation. So just like, it's just like this. When you want to explain transcendental subject matter, then you have to use the language that people can understand. Now, Sanskrit is a very wonderful language in that it is just suited for expressing transcendental subject matter. You may know from Nectar of Devotion, for instance, there are mentioned in Rupa Goswami's analysis of transcendental emotions. There are words given, Sanskrit words given. They're in the text, Prabhupada's translation. But then Prabhupada says these words cannot be rendered into English. There's no English equivalent. So that immediately means that although there's a Sanskrit meaning, a Sanskrit understanding, our present day languages simply are not developed, advanced enough to convey these meanings. These languages we speak nowadays are very low. English is a marketplace language. It is actually the whole idea or the whole background of the English language. It has come into being from business, because English is a very corrupt language. There are words, it says that English has more words in it than any other language except Chinese. And Chinese, they have so many words because in Chinese their alphabet, every symbol in their alphabet is a word. They don't have letters. They just have words. So therefore, they start off with something like 60,000 symbols, and then they combine those to make more words. So it's the Chinese dictionary is naturally so big, very, very big. And then number two in the world is English, because English has borrowed words from everywhere, from classical sources like Latin, Greek, even Sanskrit, but also other modern-day languages. And the whole reason for that is because of business. You have to talk the language of the people you deal with. So in international trading, they picked up so many words. So, you know, it's a, these languages fit a certain mentality. So the only transcendental language actually is Sanskrit. It's a language of the transcendental mentality. But Sanskrit is practically, even in India, died out. It's considered, like in the West, like Latin. Who speaks Latin nowadays in the West? Only a few scholars. So, in the Bengali language, which is, Bengali is a, you know, it's derived from Sanskrit, but it's a very plebeian, that word means public language, just commonplace language, simple language. So in the Bengali language, there's this word aula, which has been taken from Persian. So it means afflicted. So they've taken that word to try to convey the sense of Mahaprabhu's affliction and transcendental love. Just like right now, as we're speaking in the English language, we're saying love, love of God. But when you go out in the Karmi society, English-speaking Karmi society, and see how they use the word love, it means sex. So a person who's very gross, materialistic, only educated in the mundane meanings of words, if he hears this expression, love of Krishna, then, you know, it's very likely he'll take it in the wrong way, unless it is explained to him. So in the same way, these owls, they have seen in the Shastra, this word aula is used to describe Mahaprabhu's emotions, and they've taken it in the mundane way. And they think, yes, Mahaprabhu, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he's on the highest platform of spiritual consciousness, and he's feeling this intense aula. And they take it to mean lusty feelings. So then it follows that in this owl group, the whole so-called sadhan is simply to intensify lusty feelings. So they have some kind of philosophy. That philosophy is that the men in this cult call themselves Purusha, or the male factor and enjoyer. They surround themselves with many women who are known as Prakriti, or the female principal. They engage in illicit activities with these women and call this sadhana, or the practice for attaining an elevated state. Although these men have a wife, they have no compunction to cohabit with other women or other wives, other aulas wives. And they don't restrict their own wives from maintaining illicit relationships with other aulas or purushas. So this, and it's also mentioned here, this is an example. We were talking yesterday of the sahaja humility. This is an example of that. You see, oh, you want my wife? Take her. And while you're taking her, maybe I can also have your wife. Oh, no problem. You are also Vaishnava. So in this way they're doing Vaishnava Seva, trading the wives around. So, yes, anyway, we don't really have to dwell on this. It's obvious how they've gone wrong philosophically in the philosophy and in their practice. So, also in the history of ISKCON, I don't like to dwell on this too much, but similar kinds of things have gone on and are still going on, I have noticed. Just like I don't know how openly I should speak. But I noticed in one yatra recently how, in the name of divorce and remarriage, you see, it's been like kind of done in that way. Wives are being traded around. Actually, not just in one place. There are several places I've been recently. This is going on. There's household couples, and they have some trouble, as Prabhupada says, if the relationship is based on illicit sex, then very soon it will break down. They will become dissatisfied with each other. And because of the illicit sex, the lust has inflamed. So then they start looking at other women, other wives, other men's wives, and thinking, oh, she's nice. In the meantime, that husband, he's having trouble with her. So then the convenient arrangement is, all right, I'll divorce my wife, you divorce your wife, and we'll trade. But because there's this divorce and remarriage, everyone thinks it's all right. But according to Srila Prabhupada, wasn't it in today's purport? I think it was mentioned in the class. Divorce is absolutely forbidden in Vedic culture. So this is, Prabhupada said many times, this is just prostitution. So they try to hide it with divorce, remarriage, but this is the Aul Sampradaya re-manifesting.
So by trial and error,
yeah, by trial and error. The Purusha is trying to find his Prakriti. Yes, by trial and error. That is the process. So this is the Aul Sampradaya. Now, next, Saki Beki. So, Saki. Saki refers to the transcendental female associates of Srimati Radharani. As we read in Chaitanya Charita, teachings of Lord Chaitanya, they are actually Radharani's expansions. Lalita, Vishakha, and others. And Beka is a corrupt form of the word Vesha. So Vesha means dress. So a Saki Beki is one who dresses up like a gopi. And they're still around today. One sees them in Bengal and also in Vrindavan Dham. So this principle that we've already spoken of in the Auls, trying to, in this body, in this material body, with this material mind, agitate the emotions, thinking these emotions that we experience in this conditioned state, when they're agitated more and more and more, then it just comes up to Mahaprabhu's Mahabhav. So, as the Auls are doing in their relationships with women, so the Saki Bekis are doing, dressed up as women. So, they're generally all homosexual. No, there's also maybe women too. And then that's connected with the next one, Chudadhari, which we'll get to in a moment. But the Saki Beki, there are, it seems that the majority of the Saki Bekis are homosexuals. So they consider that in that kind of relationship, they lusty relationship, that they experience the Madhura Ras.
Men and women both, when they dress up, when they dress up as Sakis?
Women also can do. But generally it's a male thing.
Dress up as Sakis.
Yeah. Women may also do. That is also, sometimes we see in ISKCON, for instance, there are women who, like especially unmarried ladies, who although they're not married, they come into the temple in all finery, you know, nice flashy sari and makeup and earrings and ornaments and everything. And when asked, why are you dressing like this? It's for Krishna. So this is a similar manifestation of the same mentality. Because the point is that Krishna is not interested in this bag of bone, blood, flesh. This does not give him any pleasure. Now, an interesting question was raised when I was talking about this in Sweden. Someone said, but in any case, for instance, the ladies in our movement, they do wear saris, so the gopis wear saris, so... But we must keep in mind, just as Tamal Krishna Maharaj was mentioning, there is the Varna Ashram Dharma, which all human beings, in order to be counted as civilized, must follow. So in ISKCON, we also follow, to a certain extent, Varna Ashram Dharma. And that extent is seen, for instance, in the